This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, ask language, did it hurt when you fell from heaven? Coming up in today's show, cringing and catharsis. To set you up for today's episode, here's the history of embarrassment. The word, not the emotional state, which I imagine is the exact same age as consciousness. The word is relatively recent. The first recorded usage of embarrass, conveying awkwardness and shame, is only from 1828. Although it had been around a while before that, its first known appearance in English was in Samuel Pepys's diary of 1664, when embarrass meant that there was some kind of hindrance or blockage or confusion. English got it from French, which got it from Spanish, in which it now means pregnant, perhaps because you're blocked by a baby. But if you keep going, then it gets tricky. I've read two theories, the first that the Spanish embarazar evolved from the Latin word barra, a bar, so you were hindered or imprisoned by bars, and analogously in the modern sense of embarrassment, you're imprisoned or hindered by your shame. The second theory is that it's from the Portuguese embarazar, in which the barazar means a rope or a noose. Some people therefore posit that the modern sense of embarrassment comes from the historical punishment of having to go around wearing a noose, displaying your shame to everybody. But I think given the journey of the word from Portuguese to 19th century English, this might be a bit of a leap. But not as much of a leap as the one made by the surprisingly large number of people who think, well, embarrass, it's obviously from someone's skirt being wafted up by the wind, so they were embarrassed. No. Has our time together meant nothing to you? Don't be misled by superficial similarities. I know it's comforting to find patterns in the world, but don't embarrass yourself. And now for today's Radiotopian special guests, who are, I'd say, students of embarrassment.
Hey, this is Neil.
And this is Dave.
And you're listening to Mortaflusionist.
Neil and Dave are the creators of Mortified, which started as a stage show in 2002. And as of this year, there's been a podcast as well, featuring those brave people who get up there and read out the things they wrote as teenagers. Letters, plays, and most of all, diaries. Through history, diaries have been extremely valuable sources of social and linguistic information, like the aforementioned diary of Samuel Pepys, thanks to which historians can glean a lot of little details about 17th century life in London, as well as big events he witnessed, such as the Great Plague and the Fire of London, and they can trace words, such as embarrass. Over the years of Mortified, Neil and Dave have read thousands of diaries from the past few decades, so I wanted to find out what they'd learned.
I couldn't put an exact date or year on it, but we have seen the evolution of how teenagers write and express themselves over the past 30 years. And there's certain words or certain phrases that have popped up that were not there originally. Like, I remember probably in the first 5 years of doing Mortified, there was a moment where LOL started popping up in people's journals. And that's such a like a computer age term that I'd never even heard before computers.
Yes, LOL has been used to mean laugh out loud since it sprang up in Usenet forums in the 1980s, but it was around in the 1960s as well as a medical abbreviation for little old lady. Not only that, LOLINAD meant little old lady in no apparent distress, and LOLFDGB stood for little old lady fall down go boom. Not the most sensitive diagnosis.
And then there was at some point kids would start writing cool, K-E-W-L.
That point was the early 1990s.
And like the use of emojis, like we just had a girl who was sharing live journal stuff with us and she got really into like the early days of live journal emojis and she was completely misusing them where she'd be like, today's mood, pineapple.
It can take us a while to learn how to use our new toys. But where do the online options fit in to the long tradition of diary keeping?
Blogs, like personal blogs, as opposed to like fashion blogs or something. I think personal blogs are really just like magazine columns more than diaries because they know that there's theoretically an audience. Even if it's a live journal page from 1998 with an audience of 15, there's still an audience of 15.
For most people, typing is quicker than writing by hand, so when keeping a digital journal, public or not, your writing is more likely to be able to keep up with the speed of your thoughts. Does that change the results?
I think it does. I know for myself, actually writing on a computer is a little closer to the speed in which my mind processes whatever thoughts I'm going through. Like, it works really fast, and writing it down in a notebook is almost too slow. So like I get frustrated because I'm like seven thoughts ahead of what I'm actually writing. So I'd actually prefer to like just have a blank word processing page that I could much more quickly get my stream of consciousness out.
Do you think that that built-in filter of your brain can't keep up with your pen versus when you're typing and it can all kind of spill out, that built-in filter, I wonder if that is helpful, though, in some way. There's sort of a benefit to the fact that we can't sort of fart out everything onto the page and that that our hand can only be so selective.
Yeah, I think so. I think it does. I think it forces you to slow your thoughts down and maybe organize them a little bit more than you might. Might even create a desire to sound more eloquent.
And it is more of a pain to edit it, so you have to try to get it right first time.
I often think about like how people back even in the days of like typewriters, before even electric typewriters, like the words were not as disposable. Right now, like if I can type a whole paragraph and then just toss it and I don't have to worry about like, ugh, I gotta have to retype a whole new version. Like, no, I can just change two words or something like that. I think there's this notion of the disposability of words that digital communication has created. And I'm not a Luddite. I think that that's fine. I just think it's a different thing. But I think there's this value now more than ever, kind of like vinyl albums, where seeing text, seeing handwritten text is this sort of fetishized thing to appreciate.
You know what else is interesting? I'm just thinking about this, is that when you wrote a diary like 20, 30 years ago, like, and you actually kept a physical diary somewhere in your room or whatever, and you tried to hide it so that nobody else could read it. The scariness of keeping a diary, like with the idea that it might be found and become public in some way, a physical diary was so much closer to feeling of like a very like scary, almost public thing to do. But nowadays, keeping a physical diary is so much less public than any other form of communication.
I think it's the awkward conflict between public and private that has prevented me from ever keeping a personal diary. Whenever I've tried, I've found that I was almost immediately stymied by not knowing to whom to pitch it. The notion of anyone else reading it was so appalling, I couldn't address it to another person, even an imaginary one, but the prospect of myself reading it in the future was, well, mortifying, with or without an audience to witness it. But just writing it to no one didn't come naturally to me. So how does everyone else deal with this?
I think it varies. Everybody writes in their journal in a different way. Some people are writing to their journal as if their journal is like a friend. And so they're writing to that friend.
Like Anne Frank.
Yeah, a lot of girls and men have been inspired by Anne Frank calling her diary Kitty, as if the diary is a person.
Yeah, so that's one way. And then some people have literally written in their diary as if they were talking to the world, like just talking to a much larger audience. And then some people write as if they're just talking to themselves.
I'm fascinated by like the habits people keep. There's habits, I think, that form that sort of dictate how people talk. Not only are they talking to the diary as a person, but some people wind up naming their diaries, like each diary gets a different name. Usually it's a woman who does this. Some women, all of their diaries become named Barbara, right? And then other people, every time they get a new diary, the first one is Barbara, the second one is Clara, or what, I don't know why I'm picking names from the 1950s. The third one is Helen, and so on and so on. Then the weirder thing is like we had Jill Crenshaw as this girl who performs in our show. All of her diaries are men. Ivan, they were all like Russian names too. I don't know what that was about. Sasha Rothschild, who performs on our show, she calls her diary, I believe, but her big habit is she only writes in like purple pen ever since she was 8.
So if you manage to find a narrative voice and you've got the perfect pen with which to write in Cynthia or Vladimir, what then? What are you keeping a diary for?
So I didn't keep a journal when I was a kid or a teenager, but I did start keeping a journal after college, when I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life in my early to mid 20s, what we in America call our quarter life crisis. And I think I was just keeping it for an outlet to be creative, but also a place to try to work out. I don't know. Maybe I may have just kept it as a way not to stare at girls on the subway because I was living in New York. And so I probably was partially that, but no, I think I was just working through, like I wasn't doing what I wanted to do for my life and what I thought I was going to be doing when I graduated college. And so it was just this outlet for me to work out my feelings about feeling like a failure in life.
What's it like going back to read them?
It's a confirmation of in some ways that you're just sort of reminded of how much you're still that same person that you were 15 years ago. I definitely wish I would have kept a journal regularly in my elementary and junior high and early high school years. You know, when you have so many years removed from certain periods of your life, you don't really remember what it was really like because your brain starts to eliminate so many of those memories that you're only left with this very specific moments. What a diary gives you is it gives you these moments of minutia that you manage to write down. And the minutia actually opens up a part of your memory that is kind of more deeply locked away. And it allows you to connect to who you were when you were a kid in a way that your sort of normal memory can't do. And so that's what I wish I could have kept.
So let's hear the mortified pro tips for writing a diary.
Make sure you do two things. Write about the actual event, describe the event or the actual concrete thing that happened, and then also analyze it. Write about the emotional impact of it, but don't just do one of those things. If you just write about like your emotions in your journal, but it's not rooted to actual experiences, it's not that helpful. And it's almost not helpful if you do the reverse, which is you're just writing down your experiences like a list. You need to both write down your experiences, but make sure to include your perspective and yourself almost as a character in it. Our memory doesn't always place us as a character in those memories, but a journal does.
Whatever you're thinking, don't censor yourself. Just spill your guts out onto a page. That doesn't mean that's going to be enjoyable to anybody, including yourself, years later or even in the present tense. But I do think it's really helpful getting stuff out. I think a lot of us are so arrogant. We think like, oh, I understand my issues or whatever. And it's like, I think only when you get it out of your noggin do you start to be able to kind of see it from you need to see your life as like in like the third person. And that's something that a journal does.
Dave Nadelberg and Neil Katcher created Mortified. It's a stage show that may be on in a town near you. It's a documentary that is well worth watching on Netflix. It's a TV show, it's books, and it's a Radiotopin podcast that will move you and entertain you and make you want to gnaw off your own hand with embarrassment by proxy. Visit getmortified.com to find all of these things and to volunteer to share your teenage writings and be part of a Mortified show. Mortified aren't the only Radiotopins that drop by this episode.
Hello.
So, Roman Mars, you invited yourself back onto my show.
Someone gets gregarious during fundraising season.
It's actually times like this that I feel the most excited about it all. Because, I don't know, when we're fundraising and we're all together, you remember the reason why you wanted to form a community around you. Like, there's really huge benefits to that.
All right, so you're just using fundraising as an excuse to have friends around.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, well, we need to raise money.
And what will the money be for?
I mean, I would say most of that money goes to just paying for the time to do the work, because the work is really hard and really time-consuming.
It is. And it's quite hard work making something that's not terrible.
Most of the money goes to that, which I think is the most of what goes into making a podcast is just human hours spent editing something so that it isn't a waste of everyone's time. To me, these are little pieces of information-filled art. And they just take time to make.
And what's Radiotopia for? What does it mean?
What does it mean?
Yeah, what is this thing that we're all in together?
It's really about creating this like perfect little utopia so that we can create the best radio. And then we as Radiotopia fundraise together and support each other and encourage each other and try to create a better place for people like us who want to do creative work in radio, but maybe get turned down a lot by the powers that be who actually decide what goes on the radio.
'Cause being part of this has been really life-changing for me.
That means, yeah. When I get worried about all the work or get down about it and think of why do I do all this stuff extra... you're my main reason I keep
really
like,
why
yeah because I love answer me this I love all your work. And to think that you are in a place where that wasn't valued to the highest extent makes me so mad that I just feel like I have to create the world in which you win because you deserve to win.
Wow.
And so that's why Radiotopia is the name of a place. You know, it's like has this idea that it's a place where the good people win.
Well, that's my ego stroked. Bye. I hope it's working for you on that level.
It is. It totally is. Radiotopia gives me a great deal of pride. It gives me lots of headaches and it takes a lot of time. And
you
costs
had headaches
money.
Anyway.
Yeah, I know. I know, but more of them.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is horst. Noun, geology. A raised, elongated block of the Earth's crust lying between two faults. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with Dave Nadelberg and Neil Katcher from Mortified. Thanks to Eleanor McDowell and Martin Austwick for the help. You can find me at Allusionist Show on Facebook and Twitter, and at theallusionist.org, where I'll be back next week with another Radiotopian. So I've got to go off and study for that episode.
Mortiflusionist.
Mortiflusionist. It sounds like a water slide.
Ooh, I want to go on that.
It sounds like a job that happens at a hospital and you're like, well, what do you do?
Yeah.
I'm a mortiflusionist. I take your bodily fluids and bottle them.
For reasons we don't
For
understand.
No apparent reason.
Everyone needs a hobby.
The mortiflusionist could also be a horror film.
Yeah.
Like about a...
A delusional florist?
Yeah. It's a delusional florist. I want him to be played by Larry Drake of Dr. Giggles fame. And I would also like pumpkin pie, but that is separate.